If you want to learn about curious moments from history while also lowering your stress, then try the new podcast, Calm History.
Each episode is narrated in a calm voice to help you to relax or fall asleep.
You'll enjoy learning about famous explorers, leaders, inventions, civilizations, and ancient wonders.
There's even a six-part series about the Titanic.
Just search your podcast player for Calm History or use the link to calmhistory.com in the episode notes.
Vocalprize Podcast, the podcast about linguistic discrimination.
I'm Carrie Gillen.
And I'm Megan Figueroa.
I wanted to say, because we waited so long and I somehow like missed this for months.
Oh no.
We owe someone a thank you.
Oh no. Well, it just means that much more because now we're like, sorry. Oh, you see, do you hear that? I got a little Canadian.
Yeah, I heard your Canadianism, yeah.
We have a sorry behind it too.
So thank you to Rory Turnbull, who's been our patron for our months and months and months and months, and I somehow missed it, even though I thanked him, and I think you sent him a sticker, and we did all the things, and it's just, oh my goodness, I feel so bad.
Oh my goodness, well thank you, we are so grateful for you.
Yes, and if anyone else would like to support us, remember that this helps us pay our editor and our transcriptionist. You can join us at patreon.com/vocalfriespod. And I also want to thank everybody for hanging on while we took, well, it was mostly me, but we took off August because I needed a mental health break because I have had a year.
Yeah, you have. Yeah, and you stuck with it, you know, August is long overdue, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, I think we probably need to take a month off every year because, wow, did I feel so much better, like, refreshed.
You're rejuvenated.
I'm a little bit rejuvenated.
I can tell from here.
I mean, some weird things happened this month that, oh my goodness, we have to talk about, but whatever.
Well, I can't wait. Ooh. You have some stuff to tell me.
Yes. Well, there are a bunch of things I could talk about, but I realized that what we probably should talk about is the situation at West Virginia University.
Oh my God. My body got like the reverse of chills, you know, like whatever it is when it doesn't feel good. It's like, do you have like an article or anything up? I don't want to get details wrong on what's happening. They basically want to cut language. Languages.
Not want to.
They are.
Are.
Yeah.
So they're eliminating its world languages department, but recommending keeping 5 teaching positions and letting students take some language courses as electives. But basically, they're getting rid of all languages except for 2. Can you guess which 2?
Spanish and Arabic.
Half right.
Spanish and Mandarin.
Right.
Okay. Because I was thinking, like, globalism and...
Well, of course. Like, of course it's going to be a big language. Like, of course. But, yeah.
Oh, my God. So 5 positions, which means they're going to be split between those 2 languages, because it's not going to be a linguistics position, because linguistics is underneath this, right?
I mean, some of them might be linguists, but they will only be teaching language.
Right.
Yes, so the linguistics is gone, like as a field, will not no longer be at this university.
I'm horrified in so many different ways, on a personnel level. These people are losing their jobs. I mean, it's not as if academia has a ton of positions to offer. You know, like, these people are just losing their jobs.
I know. And, like, it's a reminder that, you know, we have this idea that academic jobs are really stable, but they're not. Like, even tenured positions can go like that if the university just either dissolves, like it has in some cases, or it dissolves a department or two.
Right. And I wouldn't be surprised if this is, what is it, like a harbinger? Harbinger? Mm-hmm. Harbinger.
I say harbinger. I'm not going to say that that's correct, but that's how I say it.
I do wonder if the dictionary has both as correct. I never really say that word out loud, so that's why I'm second guessing myself. But it is foreshadowing. it's like telling us what's to come, I think. I think there are going to be more cuts like this. It's not good. It's setting a precedent.
I don't even think it's setting a precedent. This has happened before. Mm. I mean, an entire university in Canada folded last year.
Really?
Our friends, Mark and Eamon from the Endless Knot, both lost their jobs because of that. Now, Mark was, I think, only part-time, but still. So they lost basically like a job and a half.
Yeah, now that you say that, that is what happened. And oh my God, that's awful. And so, yeah, this is going to keep happening. I'm not surprised that the powers that be at West Virginia University decided that language and languages was the thing to go. I mean, they're never going to... I mean, I wonder if they have a business school. They're not going to cut business schools.
Of course not. That brings in total money. Although this department was also bringing in money. It was actually making the money. But business school makes probably a lot more money, I'm going to guess.
No, I read something on Slate. I think it was by someone who had graduated from one of the programs that's being cut. They were saying that it does make money in that. And so I was a little bit surprised by that because I thought it would be a clear cut case of they could say that, oh, it's just not making any money. That's why we're doing it. But no, that's not even what they can say.
Nope. Yeah, it's not smart. And apparently it all comes down to, okay, so according to Jonah Katz, an associate professor there. So again, someone with tenure, right?
Mm-hmm.
According to him, they were bringing in more than $800,000 in profit.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. And I saw like the day these cuts were announced, I think he and another person in the department, but maybe I'm wrong, people in that department were just like, just found out that they had gotten this pretty big grant. Probably from the NSF. I wasn't really paying that much attention. But the same day, they get this huge grant and then also, bye, your jobs are gone.
And so the grant's gone. I mean, maybe if they got another job, the grant certainly if they got another job, the grant would follow, I believe. But where are they going to get a job? I mean, there's just no jobs.
You can't, and you can't get a job immediately. That's not how the academic world works. So,
right.
I don't know. It's so foolish. It's pound foolish, penny wise, whatever you say. Except not even penny wise, because...
No. Things that are in the humanities are considered humanities or, you know, world languages. I mean, these things are too often considered expendable.
Mm-hmm.
Even if they're making money. Just so horrifying. And that's a state school. And so there are people at West Virginia, you know, who live in West Virginia that are dreaming of one day going to college and they're going to go there. And now, like, this is what they're inheriting.
Yep.
It's awful. It's so awful. And I just feel so much for the people that are losing their jobs. And linguistics is just being erased as an entire field. I mean, that's wild.
Yes.
And yeah, ultimately, this is going to end up hurting students who are supposed to be the ones that you're serving.
They don't care.
They don't care. Oh, that makes me very, very sad. But at least there are things like podcasts where you can learn some stuff, I guess.
Yeah. Oh, right. That actually reminds me. I completely forgot. We've had a few emails about our last episode.
Oh, the termites.
Not so much about the termites, but about our intro to that.
Which one was the intro?
Okay, well, just listen to it.
Tell me.
Just listen to it and you'll figure it out. Dear Carrie Megan, I recently listened to the latest episode and had to chuckle when you were talking about the raunchy pun hidden in plain sight in the French language poster for the Barbie movie. It reminded me of another moment I have to tell you about. Megan, I hope you get a big kick out of this one because it's related to Spanish. In The Princess Bride, there is a scene where the brute squad is clearing all the thieves and bandits out of the forest ahead of Buttercup and Humperdinck's wedding, but Inigo Montoya is drunk and refusing to leave. One of the men from the brute squad approaches and calls out, "Ho there!" Inigo snarls in response, "Keep your hoder?" To any,
oh my god.
To any monolingual English speaker, it sounds like he's saying, keep your ho there, just repeating what the other guy said. But to Spanish speakers, it's crystal clear that he's using Spain's favorite and most versatile swear.
Yeah.
It's broadly equivalent to fuck. I remember being in college, watching the movie with a bunch of friends after returning from my semester abroad in Spain, hearing him say that, and the light bulb going off. Oh my god! It's been here the whole time! I've seen this movie dozens of times since I was a little kid, and I never knew what he was really saying. It's absolutely glorious. Whoever thought to put that into the scene was inspired. It gives me great joy every time I think about it. Hope you had a chance to watch The Princess Bride sometime soon so you can enjoy it too. Best, Kelly.
Kelly, I love it.
I never picked up on that. I have watched that movie so many times. Also, I didn't know that word. Like, it's not a word.
You didn't?
No.
Yeah.
I know some swears in Spanish, not that one. So, yay.
Here's a good excuse to watch it again, as if anyone needs an excuse to watch it.
Right?
I love that.
And by the way, finally saw Barbie.
Me too.
And it was very enjoyable.
It was. Loved Ryan Gosling's abs. Loved him. I know that's not the point of the movie,
I didn't even really think about it. I mean, obviously he's got a hot body, but that's not what I was paying attention to. I was paying attention to his, like, sad, lost boy vibes.
I know. He has the nicest abs for someone who is so sad and so obsessed with horses.
Well, and just obsessed with, like, not being, like, loved in the way he wanted to be loved.
It's true. Poor kid. He's Knuff. He is
Knuff now, but he wasn't Knuff.
He wasn't.
Until the end. Anyway, there's others, and I think I'll probably continue to read them out to you in the next one, because there's some other good ones.
I love it.
Anyway, this episode is super interesting. I learned a lot about the language of death.
Yeah, me too. I get to learn so much through the podcast, and hopefully you all do too.
Yeah.
Anyway, I hope you enjoy.
Enjoy.
So we're so excited today to have Poppy Martle, who is the founder and chair of forward-thinking, award-winning funeral directors Poppies in London. Poppies are campaigning to change the way we talk about death and dying. The Dead Good Words campaign, which launched this summer, highlights how dehumanizing and euphemistic language such as disposal, removal, and deceased can lead to poor care for the dead and for grieving relatives and friends. And we're about to talk to Poppy about that very campaign. So Poppy, thank you so much for being here with us.
Yeah, thank you.
I'm so thrilled to be here. Thank you for inviting me for this conversation.
Yeah, I'm really excited about it. I've been thinking about death and dying, anticipating our conversation. And so I'm really looking forward to this. Let's just start from the beginning. Tell us a little bit about yourself and how you became a funeral director and what makes Poppies different.
I do not come from a family of people who work in death care. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how it is in the US, but certainly in the UK, it's quite normal for that work to sort of run in families. So my background is actually in the arts. So I studied history of art, and then I work at auction houses like Sotheby's and Christie's. And there is no segue. I feel people are like, and then what happened? But I think for me, the story that makes more sense is that I come from a family where like public service is kind of a big thing. So my mum was a social worker, my dad was a teacher, and we definitely were brought up to be really tuned into those kinds of ways of thinking about the world, you know, that you have a responsibility to help, I guess, in its most sort of basic form. And then what I studied and the world I worked in was so fun. It was unbelievable fun, and I loved every minute of it. But I just got to that point early in my career where I felt like the days make sense, but when I look back, I just don't feel like I'm in the right place. And so I had a couple of years of trying to figure it out and did not figure it out, and ended up taking some time out to go traveling. And I was in West Africa and I got typhoid. It's not that I almost died or that I thought I was going to die, but what I did have was then sort of like 9 months of recovery. And I think when I look back, it's like, yeah, if I didn't have that really extended gap, there's no way I would have made this kind of move. And during that time, there were something like 4 different exposés on TV about the funeral sector. So showing everything from manipulative sales techniques, so kind of overselling, mis-selling, pressurizing people to buy, all the way to really appalling care of the dead in the mortuary. So racism towards the dead and families being told people were being dressed in clothes that were then just put in like a bag at the bottom of the coffin. So just grim stuff. And if you knew me, you'd know that that is the kind of catalyst. I need that sort of like rage factor.
Yeah, yes.
And once I've got it, once I've got my fingernails in that sort of piece of rage, then it's like fear disappears. I'd never seen a dead body. I didn't know anyone who worked in the sector. And I don't think when I started out, I wasn't certain that I'd become an undertaker. I think I just thought I could get involved here. You know, this work is about gentleness and thought and care. And it's about taking something that is a completely ubiquitous experience that everybody goes through. And I think I could help. And so I started off by going behind the scenes with a bunch of funeral directors who kindly let me come in. And what I saw there ranged from nice, often quite sort of old-fashioned practices, all the way to real sort of like production line, clinical, grim. And that sort of sealed the deal for me, because there was a real sense of, okay, my family haven't been in business since 1824, like some other funeral directors, but I think I could bring some fresh air to this time in people's lives. So I set Poppies up. So we're 11 years old. So set up in 2012. And the whole mission behind Poppies is it's about trying to bring humanity and care to a time in your life that we think really matters. Because although, of course, everyone would say death matters, but actually when you think about how we are dying in the West and the rituals around death, it's like they haven't had very much thought in a very long time. And that's what we try to do. So we try to put the families and the communities that we work for right at the center of the experience and build whatever they need around them. And for some people, that might be something very affordable. For some people, that might be something with the environment at its core, you know, wanting to kind of leave the best possible legacy. For another person, it might be an orthodox religious priority or tradition. So we don't have a fixed view on what the thing should look like. We just want it to work for you.
Yeah, I was going to say that. I know it's so beautiful, because I was thinking there's not a lot of being present in the moment in those situations. And there's not much thought for a lot of families beyond how am I going to pay for this? When I realized that it could be so much more than just how am I going to pay for this? It could be how would this best represent my grandmother, or all these questions that maybe you could actually have and pursue if these details that in the West, at least in the US, is usually the first question that people have on their mind.
Absolutely. And I think it's about separating out the bits, the kind of responsibilities you have, right? So in the UK, you have a legal responsibility to do something with the person who's died, as in cremate them or bury them. But there is no legal requirement to have a ritual. We don't practice rituals because there is a legal requirement to practice rituals. We practice rituals because they move us emotionally and we need them because we're animals. And so that's the piece that I think we've sort of slightly lost track of. It's like, of course, there are these practical questions. And again, in the West, we like piling our emotions into the practical, right? That's a place we can put our feelings. And I think in doing so, we have lost sight of that there is a kind of purpose to the ritual piece too. And actually, we do know a bit about this because we've come an awfully long way around birth. Like when my mom explains what it was like when my brother and I were born in the early 80s, her memories are of being somewhat patronized and sort of bossed around by a doctor, you know, that kind of like lie back and do what I say. And my mom's view was, I just wanted to get you guys out of there as soon as possible and sort of get home and kind of escape the institution. Glad to have the medical care and then wanting to get out of there. And I think it's kind of similar with death, you know, that when I have been pregnant, we've come a long way, at least in the UK, and I think in lots of Europe and perhaps in the US too, that the idea is like, this is actually happening to you and that you might want to have a say in what the experience is like and that that might be better for you and for the health of your partner and family. And I guess for me, there's a complete mirror image with death. You know, these are the only two experiences that we will all share as human beings, as living creatures. And we should be thinking about what we need from that time, because we work with families, or I've met people in my life who have been hugely traumatized by that moment in their life. You know, there are many, many people who have really tricky memories of what happened around the dying and the death and the funeral when a parent died. You know, there are tons of people who weren't allowed to go to their dad's funeral because there was an assumption that they were being protected from an experience.
Yeah, I haven't had that experience, but my mother did try to protect me from my grandfather dying because I was in my last year of my undergrad, just about to go into exam period. And when I found out, like, I think she told me the day before he died, she finally admitted he's dying. And I was so mad that she was trying to protect me. I understood why, but I was angry.
What is the lasting impact? Do you think that's had any impact on you over time?
I don't think so. I think it's just one thing of many things where I felt like maybe she was trying to protect me too much, but I don't feel like I have that relationship with her anymore because I'm so much older. I think now I am okay, but there was a short period of time where it really did deeply impact me that she was trying to protect me from something so important. But I was able to go to his funeral. I mean, he lived in Vancouver, so it was really easy for me to be there. And it was very meaningful. It was a very meaningful service because it was full of his particular brand of Christianity. Like, it really suited him. And I did really appreciate that.
Mm-hmm. But I think that's a really good representation of what happens at a societal level, which is very much relevant to the Good Words campaign, that we think we are protecting each other and ourselves by not naming what's happening. Yeah. And in the vacuum that we create by not talking, emerges just an endless wormhole of like anxiety, fear, and sort of existential angst.
Yeah.
There is something about, why are we trying to protect each other from a natural process that is impossible to avoid?
Right.
I'm not sure it's helpful.
It's not helpful. I understood why, because I was in a stressful period of my life, but it was counterproductive in the end.
Yeah.
But yeah, so what is the Dead Good Words campaign?
This is a campaign that we at Poppies launched in the summer. From the very beginning of my interaction in the world of death care, I became aware that there were these words, some euphemistic, some jargony, some both.
Legal?
Some coming from sort of legal beginnings, but like kind of astounding that they haven't been reviewed since.
Sure.
You know, like a 150-year-old word that there's just such a lack of thought. I think that was my sense. I didn't think these are words that are intentionally malicious or designed to harm. It just felt like, oh my goodness, these words have just existed in this tiny microcosm that the public are sort of somewhat protected from, but the impact of these words is impacting people.
Yeah.
And so I felt that very, very early on. So I remember spending some time with the funeral directors and they kindly let me sort of come out on their work. So we would go and collect people who died at home. And this was called a removal. So we're going to do a removal. And you just think, I don't know that anyone thinks that the moment their dad leaves the house for the last time is a removal. That's something you do with like a splinter or like an object that you don't want to be there. That doesn't feel like the right word. We've known for 11 years, we've been doing this work, that there are all sorts of words that are unkind, thoughtless. I think there is this coalescing of the words, all of the words, because the kind of key one, disposal, is the one we really pull out. So you don't use that word in the US, you use disposition. But for us, what happens to the body is disposal. That is the kind of legal technical term for what happens to the body. And actually, if you look at the words together, you do start to see this theme of kind of like treating the body like waste. You know, there is something of kind of getting
medical
rid of
waste.
An unwanted thing. And so the reason we launched the campaign this summer was because the kind of catalyst was there's a piece of work happening in the UK to reform the law around what happens to the dead body. And we have a legal body in the UK called the Law Commission, and they're doing this piece of work, and it's a fantastic piece of work. And we've been to meet with them, and I'm so behind the piece of work. But the project was called Finding a Modern Framework for Disposal of the Dead. Mm. And there was just something about that title.
Yeah.
It was like, oh my goodness, it's like 2023, and we're finding a modern framework for disposal. And I'm thrilled to see, I was looking this morning, we've met with a bunch of times, and they've changed the title of the project. Hurrah!
Goes, oh, that's awesome.
No, it's brilliant.
That's good.
So, and what have they changed it to?
So now it's called Burial, Cremation and New Funerary Techniques, which is absolutely fine. It was such a great representation of the kind of thoughtless language that we use. And no one means to do any damage, but no one is really talking about this stuff. So the campaign, it felt like a brilliant opportunity to raise awareness of the language, some language that I think people would be familiar with and others people wouldn't be familiar with, to say, these are words you might not hear, but these words are framing your experience. And we need to start to have an opinion on this if we want the care that we receive when someone dies to improve. The campaign is not about asking for any specific change in any specific time frame. It's about beginning to raise awareness of this work that goes on behind closed doors, which impacts absolutely everyone, that we think matters hugely.
Well, and I feel like this is the perfect platform for that, because our podcast is all about awareness. Because a lot of times, Carrie and I will just, when we talk to people about this stuff, about linguistic discrimination or about how the language that we use impacts our lives, it's just about getting people to stop and think about it.
And that may seem like maybe some people want a step forward that looks different than that, but that is a huge step forward, is just being aware.
It's the first step. You can't do anything without that first step.
I mean, I'd love to hear your perspectives too over the conversation, because I was thinking about this, that when we were bringing our campaign together, like, are there going to be groups of people who really aggressively disagree with what we're saying? And on reflection, I was like, I don't think there are. You know, I don't think this is something that is kind of threatening any one party. I think this is an area of just thoughtlessness.
Yes.
And I know there are other subjects where a shift in language might represent a shift in something greater, which some people might feel is kind of infringing on their. But I think this is interesting because it's just like it's existed in this dark, taboo, shadowy corner. I hope it's simply a case of kind of shining a torchlight on and saying, does anyone know what's happening over here?
Right.
I think it's just more in this case, because death is so taboo, at least in Western societies, I think we want to use like more medical scientific terms to distance ourselves. But maybe if we step back and think about like, why are we doing that? We can actually maybe make the taboo less strong and come at it from a more caring perspective. Because yeah, it is something that happens to all of us. And what do we want to happen after we're dead? Do we really want to be discussed in these terms? Probably not. Mm-hmm. So I think this will resonate with most people.
Yeah. I think that's a really, really interesting point, because I think there are analogies and parallels. You know, I think of like when I grew up, kind of words for like private parts of my body that were used, you know, euphemisms. Yeah. And I have a daughter and it's really important to me that she knows what things are.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's true with death as well. It's like, how do I serve? There's nothing like having a conversation with a child when they have a question and it's so straightforward. And it's like, I don't want to tie you in knots. This classic thing of she's sleeping now, or this idea of death is just like one big sleep. For a child, this is absolutely petrifying and is going to really disrupt bedtime.
Yep.
Why would I choose that path, which is just like a huge knot, rather than saying, okay, look, there's this tough thing, but we're all in it together. And I can stand by your side as we kind of look at it and question it. And like, I don't have all the answers and you don't have all the answers, but there's nothing wrong with that questioning and questioning and questioning. And I think that's the challenge with the taboo and the euphemisms, is there's no doubt that like death is petrifying and that loss is petrifying, but we really don't help ourselves by hurling in all these other tangles.
I'm in total agreement. I was thinking this is going to perhaps disrupt how people think about death and dying, but I think the big issue is going to be whether they're going to be willing to address it, willing to even listen, stop, think. You know, when there are content warnings and stuff, there are content warnings about death and dying. And so it's this thing where it's like, are people going to even engage? And not because it's going to have to shift like political views or something like this. It's like, can they emotionally do it?
And I think the work of Poppies is interesting in that way. You know, we're not some sort of tech startup that's looking to kind of come in and get out within 5 years.
Right.
The work we're doing is actually the work that our ancestors have been doing for a very, very, very long time. Caring for the dead is obviously a very ancient way to care for people in the community. And I think it's true with this shift too. As I say, it's not like we'll demand this change by the 1st of September. It's absolutely saying we get this privileged access to this privileged world, and it doesn't feel right that it stays private to us. Mm-hmm. And I don't think this stuff is going to change overnight. There are moments, I know in the UK, there have been moments, particularly around exposés of kind of horrible care, or, you know, that it's sort of sudden bolts of lightning happen. But you're absolutely right. This is a decades long project to kind of try and tempt people, as I think is happening with other things like mental health. This stuff has always been around. It will always be around. We think it would help if we brought it into the light.
Yeah.
Like, who's willing to come into the light with us?
You know? Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I feel the same way about when I like casually mention that I go to therapy.
Yeah.
It's like, come on. I want to say it without halting, or just say it casually, because I don't want there to be any stigma certainly coming from me about it. So I think of the same way. And I think with death and dying too, like me being able to talk about it the way I am right now, it took me a long time to get here. I don't think like 10 years ago, this would have been a conversation that was easier. Something that I would have been able to partake in the same way. So,
do you still use like really euphemistic language around death? Like, how do we say it now?
Passed away?
Passed away, or do you say dead?
I say died, unless I'm like, does that person need me to say passed away?
Yeah, same.
What about you, Poppy?
That's actually something I really wanted to sort of make sure I got across. It's like, this is not some like dictatorial finger waggy, like, you all need to say died. Because similarly in our work, we will lead with the facts. And then if we hear that someone is using a different word, we'll use that word in the same way that someone calls and says, my dad has died, and we'll say your dad. If they say my dad, we'll say your dad. If they say Mr. Smith, we'll say Mr. Smith. Like any emotionally intelligent person, you're mirroring the person who should have power, you know, who should not be the one with power in a situation. I think the crucial thing here is that we are the ones with power at the beginning.
Yeah.
And so it is not for us to set the tone. And I feel that true if I'm in meetings with colleagues in hospices or hospitals or other religious institutions. Part of the work is kind of trying to help them become aware of the power they have over other people, even though they don't want to or mean to. You know, it's like, again, just like when people are born, we are serving people at their most vulnerable. And so I think you have to go into that interaction really mindful of how you are setting the tone, even if you don't mean to.
And speaking of setting the tone, how did we get to this place? Did you say 150 years ago? Like, what is the history of this language?
It's sketchy. It's so sketchy and it's hard. I've tried to pin it down, and no doubt if I went and buried myself in the British Library for 3 years, I would find out. And I haven't done that yet.
You should hire a lexicographer to help you with that.
Totally.
Yeah, I was like, that sounds like a fun project.
It would be so fascinating. As my work ambles on, I hope I'll find out more. But so what we do know is, so one is that this language disposal has certainly been used for like the last 100 years in UK law. And my guess is that it probably emerged from probably the kind of 19th century, like times where in the UK, populations were exploding, massive kind of overcrowding in the cities, overcrowding in the cemeteries, and plagues and cholera. And I think times where we probably went from thinking of death as something that was happening in the family to something that was happening in society and had to be handled in a kind of mass way. And that's the way the language is framed now, you know, that it is about kind of societal responsibility to dispose of the dead safely.
Yeah.
So I think that's where the kind of disposal language has come from. When it comes to euphemism, I think you would be able to track euphemisms alongside our transition from thinking of death as something that happened often at all ages in every family to something that now feels like a sort of medical failure. You know, obviously it happens to all of us, but like all of the language, it's not just around death, around kind of saving a life or battles with cancer, and not picking on those words, because again, if they work for your family, then they work for your family. But that we do now talk about death as if like we failed that person. And I think euphemisms must be correlated with that. You know, that as you've said, the more we distance ourselves from it being part of life. I did a little bit of Googling today. I don't know if these are euphemisms you guys use, but you know, like shuffle off this mortal coil is from Hamlet, you know. So I don't know that Shakespeare meant that as a euphemism, probably more like poetry.
Yeah.
There are phrases, aren't there, like meet your maker, which I assume have a kind of biblical origins. Pushing up the daisies is another, you know, there are all of these euphemisms that probably started in probably like lovely creative phrases, and we've used them to save us from actually having to say what's actually happened. So again, I'm not against poetry. I'm not against finding beautiful, creative, flexible ways of describing one's experience. But it's when we use those words because we're so scared, like we'll jinx ourselves if we say the actual word. And I hear, I mean, obviously I'm tuned in now, but when a celebrity dies or something in the UK, it's so common for the headline to be about sort of past. Or if you hear newsreaders using language to try and explain that someone's died, you hear them stumbling and fumbling around it. Like,
oh,
you
know, interesting.
Don't make me say the D word. Every now and then you see the word died and you almost want to be like, yeah.
Well, yeah, no, I
don't think it's as common in North America. I think we use dead much more frequently, at least in the headlines.
You have something called the Dead Good Words Manifesto. Will you tell us about that?
Yes. There are so many words. It was really hard to come up with the top eight.
Yeah.
But we felt when you care so passionately about something and you're trying to raise awareness, you don't want to fall down your own belly button. You know, you want to kind of pick on the words that you think people are going to resonate with the most. So we pulled together the kind of eight words or phrases that we felt were most impactful and just created a manifesto for change. So it's about raising awareness of those eight words or phrases and then suggesting alternatives that sound so obvious, you know. So disposal is the kind of headline. It feels like surely no one thinks we should be talking about disposing of our dead people.
Right.
And obviously you can replace that with burial or cremation, or at Poppy's we we use the word reposal, which we really like. So we're kind of trialing it, just a whole new word.
Yeah.
Which may or may not take off, but we wanted to prove that it was possible to come up with a new word. And then there are phrases there that are very much based in our world. So removal is one, which is when someone is collected after they've died, and viewing is another. So in the UK, anyway, people talk about, funeral directors say, you know, when you come and view your mum, and a sense that we have of like, you don't view your mum, you view a prospective property, you know, or you view an artwork. Right. Your mum is right. still a person after she dies. So we talk about coming to visit your mum. It's all about humanizing the words with the intention to humanize the experience. We don't want you to feel you are doing business with us. We want to feel like you are having an experience with your mum.
That's so interesting. I never would have thought of viewing as being dehumanizing, but you're right. It is. But
yeah, it's like being at a museum.
It's an object. You view an inanimate object for sure.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It suggests no relation. Lovely. All the way through to kind of, in the UK, embalming is sometimes called hygienic treatment.
Oh, whoa.
And because embalming is such an invasive and toxic procedure that is right for some people. But I think in the UK, there aren't exact statistics, but it's believed that between 30 to 40% of people are embalmed. And at Poppies, we embalm less than 1% of people. Oh, and gosh. I think that's just because we tell people what it is and ask them if they want it. And they mostly say no, where I think other funeral directors are saying, this is why you should have it.
Yeah.
They're just like saving a lot of people from having to go through that process. And then through to euphemisms like, so we picked on loved one, which is a bit provocative because it's such a widely used phrase in the UK, not just around death. So again, in the media, loved one is like the safe term to describe everybody in relation to the person who's died. But it started to be used now, just if something happens to someone, the media will talk about their loved ones. And the thing that we're sort of calling out is just this kind of, not everybody is a loved one. For lots of reasons, you know, so we work with families on a relatively regular basis who are stepping up to arrange the funeral of someone who they have been estranged from for 30 years and had a really complicated relationship with, but like an incredible citizen or like an incredible child, they are taking responsibility and doing it. So we're kind of like fighting for them a little bit. And then on the other side, just feeling like if I died, I hope I'm not just a loved one. The people I really am closely in relationship with, I way more than just love them.
Yeah, you're Poppy, right?
I feel all the feels towards them. And some of this is a little bit playful too, you know, that it's about saying when we kind of use this very like flat, safe language, we kind of minimize people's experience. And that's a shame.
So I'm thinking loved one can be both parties. And so it's like I said, like you're Poppy, I'm Megan, Carrie's Carrie. Like I would think that certainly I would still want to be Megan after I die.
Totally. And in the UK, at least, the dead person is the deceased and the family and friends and loved ones. Okay. We don't like any of this. You know, my sense is like, I'm Poppy. And I always sort of slightly joke, like, how many people are we caring for in our mortuary that we can't remember their names, right? Like, if my kid's primary school teacher can remember the names of the kids in her class, we should be able to remember the names of the people in our mortuary, or at least have them on a name band or have a way of thinking of them as Mr. This or Tom or whatever the name is. And the same with loved ones. So, you know, if you want to find a phrase to describe everyone, then I would go for like friends and family or community or words that consider them to be people, not these kind of like loved one is just like, look, loved one boxed off. It just doesn't feel human.
I like community. Yeah, I like that. That's community.
That's probably the safest one because, you're not making any judgment about like how you're in community with each other.
Yeah.
How would you want your rituals to go?
Yeah, such a good question. And changing all the time.
Okay, cool.
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the really incredible privileges of my work is like you get to walk alongside people at this time in their lives. You see families completely at war with each other in a family that death creates these kind of, I don't think it's the death that creates it, but I think death can be the catalyst for something that's probably been brewing for a very long time. Mm-hmm. Everybody's like tired and emotional, but also the other way around, like watching communities take care of each other so beautifully in the wake of a death. And so I think I've learned a lot from other people. So I used to think that I wanted to be cremated because I like the idea of, I like fire. I like the idea of being kind of reduced to not much. And I grew up by the seaside and I like the idea of having my ashes scattered in the sea.
Yeah.
As I have understood more about climate change and the planet and wanting to leave a positive legacy and understanding that ashes are quite alkaline and totally inert, it doesn't feel any more like something that I would want. So I'm taken by two ideas. One is natural burial, just the idea of being buried on a piece of land. So sometimes natural burial grounds will be meadows or woodlands, but the whole idea is you're put underground and there is no maintenance of the land. So it might be like a wildflower meadow, or it might be a place where sheep graze, but the land is not being upkept with a memorial to me. But I also love this new choice that is taking America by storm called natural organic reduction or human composting.
Yes.
I think there are 7 states now in the US where it's legal, and Seattle is where it's being practiced, but where the body is turned to soil. That is not currently an option for me because we don't practice that yet in the UK, but that would be very cool too, because it produces nutrient-rich soil that the earth could use. Yeah. And then when it comes to the ceremony, I feel like I would really want my friends and family to do what they needed to do in the moment. Because again, I think I've seen that from working with families, that it depends hugely on what are the circumstances. 10 years ago, I had a husband. Now I have 3 small children. What my family would need now has really changed. If I die at like 110 and there's no one left, you know, it's like, feel free to just put me in the ground, like no pressure.
Right.
No pressure for anyone to like bus in and come. But I believe in the power of ritual. So I love a bit of singing, love a bit of dancing, eating, any way that my funeral can help you process these emotions or past emotions, then I would love that.
You've used the word ritual. Why is it important for you to call these things rituals?
Because I think if we don't think of it as a ritual, we risk thinking that we're at like our school assembly and kind of like going through the motions. Funerals that I've been to where I felt like needs were not met have been funerals where the experience has been dictated by someone's idea of what is proper. And I don't use the word, again, I want to be really careful not to be judgmental of like a really traditional, perhaps religious funeral that is meeting people's needs is the most powerful funeral that you could have in that instance. I'm not critical of tradition. I'm critical of lazy, repetitive actions that meet no one's needs. And sometimes those going through the motions, let's call them traditions, can actually do harm. Because if you've turned up somewhere to feel close to and remember someone you love deeply, and what you experience is a complete whitewash of who they were, it may have been better for you not to have gone, you know, that it may have been better for you to have stayed at home with some photos and a candle and some music that you know they loved and felt close to them that way. So I'm really worried about any ritual that actually is kind of akin to, I've got all these things in my head, like when you want to go traveling in India and you have to go to the passport office and then you have to go and get your visa and kind of standing in line and waiting, and then you get the stamp and then you get to go. And it's like, sometimes I feel like we're standing in line and getting the stamp, but like we're not getting to go.
Yeah. It's just the bureaucratic part.
Yeah, really, bureaucratic part, or just a sense of like what is expected of me. And particularly if it's a loss that's really significant to you, like you might need something specific. And I think I use the word ritual really loosely, because I think a ritual is having a cup of tea every morning and sitting on your patio. You know, I think a ritual is always wanting to pick up your kids on a Friday and going for ice cream. And I guess that's the thing that I'm trying to help the communities that we support recognize, is like, we're not wishing you to have necessarily a religious experience or a spiritual experience, but if there's a small part of you that would like to come and paint your mum's nails, or if you want to organize it so that like on Friday at 7 or at midday when the cremation is taking place, everyone in your community is lighting a candle and you know that's happening and that's really powerful for you. I just think in the rush to kind of get the paperwork done and pay the bill, that we just might risk missing the most important bit. And we know this is true, right? We know this is true from other points in our life. Like it's that whole bridezilla wedding thing, right? There's a danger that you're so obsessed with the flowers and the photos and the kind of chair covers. And it's like, hang on, I thought today was about love and connection. Right. It's no different. It's just like, don't miss this chance to get what you want and need from this experience.
Yeah, well, that's also like, lovely.
It's so lovely, because I'm thinking so much of the experiences I've had around death and dying have been like institutional muscle memory, where it's like basically going through what people expect. And my grandma's funeral, I was 15 and she was very important to me. The whole, there's this like religious leader who is at the grave site where she's going to be buried, and he doesn't even know who she is. And I was like, why are we going through, like, why? And then it was a little bit windy and the paper that he was holding that had any information about her blew out of his hand and went into the grave. And so like, then he had nothing to say. So this is the moment where I was like, this is not something that I need or want. And then there are people who needed it and said, oh, that's Pauline and she made the wind do that and she's being funny. And I was like, that's not how I see this. And that's not what I need to say or feel. And so like, that was my experience. And I think having that experience that didn't feel like a good ritual for me made me realize that I want better rituals.
Thank you for sharing that experience, because I think it's really not that specific experience, but I think that feeling of being a little bit shortchanged by what's the norm is really familiar to people. And I think there's another voice in our head that's like, shush, suck it up, and everyone else seems fine. And I think the thing that we're trying to kind of open people's minds about is like, everybody's needs can be met in different ways. So I'm thinking of families we've supported where there have been factions or parts of the family who have needed that really formal, historic set of moments. So then the question becomes, okay, we've got to do that, but is there a way for the other people to get what they need too? And so fabulous experiences of like, okay, so the day is going to be this big formal marching thing. The day before, how about everybody comes in their jeans with their pens and paper and like writes letters to go in the coffin?
Yeah.
There are ways of having everybody's needs met. And it is kind of on funeral directors to get a bit more thoughtful and creative about why they exist. You know, that they are not there to kind of like lug around the dead. They are there to help people facilitate meaningful moments.
Yeah, and your job is really about the living.
It should be. Yeah. I mean, it should be about, my sense is like, again, because I have young children, I'm just like awash with parallels. So forgive me, but it's like, I do think there's something really reassuring about knowing that my kids are being cared for. Well, it's, well, I know they're alive, but it's the same. I'd still want the same for my mum. So we take care of the dead beautifully in service to the living. And we also help the living experience ceremony and ritual that serve them too. So I think great care for both serves the living.
Poppy, you make me wish that there was poppies in the US.
Well, there probably are. You just don't
probably
know.
Are.
This experience. Yeah, because I would want to talk to someone like you and be like, how can I make this experience more artistic? I would want it to be like that letter writing thing, like something like that. Like, that's really neat. And I think of like, I'm also Mexican-American. I'm thinking about Dia de los Muertos, like how beautiful and colorful and how important like the flowers are and what they represent, all these things. And like, I would want it to be more colorful and beautiful and something like having all their favorite things and this kind of thing.
And I think that's a really good thing that you've raised, because I think back to that thing we were saying at the beginning about how sometimes traditions that we think have been around for a million years are actually quite recent. Like, it's actually very recent in our history that we've been caring for the dead and grieving people in this kind of like mechanized industrial way. You know, that if you look at pagan, Christian, all religions, for all of us, our ancestors had annual festivals, days to feel close to the dead. You know, whether that be Dia de los Muertos or Halloween or All Hallows Day or Samhain is something that pagans practiced in the West, you know, so there are all these historic opportunities to look at death, reflect on death, feel close to your dead ancestors that were nothing to do with fake blood or or scary. It was about communing with your family and your community. It's actually a very recent and, fingers crossed, short-lived stage in our evolution where we are sort of treating the dead like waste to be disposed of.
Right.
Well, that's a really beautiful place to end, I think. But do you have one last message for our listeners?
What you would hope they would take away from our conversation?
I hope the conversation has conveyed what I strongly feel, which is that by talking about death and dying with gentleness and compassion for other people and for yourself, you can live a much richer life. You know, that engaging with this subject is about acknowledging that our lives are finite and they are a fantastic opportunity to be on the planet and to be good to one another and not to be afraid of using death as a lens to live a richer life.
That's also beautiful.
Oh my goodness. I mean, I know that you're experienced in talking about these things, but still give me chills.
I've loved it. Thank you for having me.
Oh, yeah, thank you. This has been a beautiful conversation.
And I
will appreciate it.
I'm glad you found your calling, because I really feel you have felt it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank goodness. Yeah. And the last thing is just check us out. So we're on social media at Poppy's Funerals, and website is poppiesfunerals.co.uk. There's lots of information on both the work that we do and the kind of campaigns we run. So I'd love people to check us out.
And you have a blog.
We have a fabulous blog called Talking Death. It is a really good read. It ranges from how to keep your dead person at home after they die, like super practical stuff, all the way to the history of sort of like Rastafarian funerals. And, you know, it's really, really kind of varied and interesting.
It's
so please check
that
out too.
Yeah, really, I really appreciated looking at that last night too. And I'm going to go back and look at more. But just thank you so much. And we always live our... Did you hear me, Carrie? I said we always live.
Yes. There you go.
Freudian slip, that weird Freudian slip. We always leave our listeners with one final message. Don't be an asshole.
Don't be an asshole.
The Vocal Fries podcast is produced by me, Carrie Gillen, theme music by Nick Granum. You can find us on Tumblr, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Vocal Fries Pod. You can email us at vocalfriespod@gmail.com, and our website is vocalfriespod.com.